Solidarity number 703, 20th of March 2024, page 2. Our demands and a workers' government, editorial. Shadow Chancellor Rachel Reeves has responded to Jeremy Hunt's 6th March budget by saying that things will be difficult under a Labour government and she may have to cut public spending. Hunt made some tax cuts, 2% off national insurance, scooped Labour's plan to end the non-domiciled tax exemption for rich people and squared it all with the fiscal rules by projecting public spending cuts in years ahead. Reeves makes dogma of no tax rises on the rich other than ending a few loopholes. So do the math, as they say. A first answer to Reeves was given by Andrew Harrop of the Labour Rights Fabian Society. Quotes, Labour will easily find other ways to raise taxes on wealthy people who pay too little, end quotes. Raising enough in more taxes from the rich and well-off to meet immediate demands is easy in arithmetic terms. The Tax Justice Foundation offers measures which between them would raise £50 billion a year. The main items are a small wealth tax, taxing capital gains at the same rate as income tax, and levying national insurance on investment income as well as wages. The context, total UK output is reckoned at £2,700 billion a year. Government spending is about £1,200 billion, some double counting there when the income tax part of public sector workers' pay passed only from one section of government to another. Looking at it in class terms, some things like £800 billion of that £2,700 billion goes to the basic working class, bottom 80% of households, around £500 billion to a well-off but not rich 15%, £350 billion to the top 5%, £450 billion to the expansion of capital, and £500 billion in government purchases, some of it stuff for the NHS, some of it weapons. Of the income of the rich and big business, £40 billion is bank profits, 2022, and £90 billion dividend payments 2023. The BMA calls for about £7 billion a year more on the NHS. Campaigners want another £2 to £3 billion for schools, £8 billion for adult social care. It would cost about £2 billion to restore the early years Sure Start programme and about £0.5 billion to restore libraries. Still enough headroom to cover the withdrawn promise of £28 billion a year on green conversion. It is easy, except that Reeves pledges to be pro-business. It is a question of class, working class versus business class. The first time item on the agenda of the fight for a workers' government is to rouse the labour movement so it forces a labour government to tax the rich to rebuild public services. That's far from the full agenda. A labour movement capable of winning those tax rises must also be pushing to restore its capacity to win. It will demand the repeal of all the anti-strike laws, the Thatcher-era ones, as well as the Trade Union Act 2016 and the Minimum Services Law, which Starmer says he will repeal. It will demand restoration of civil liberties with repeal of all the anti-protest laws back to the Public Order Act 1986, at least, and full control of the police by democratic local authorities. It will demand full rights for migrants, open borders, free movement, and reversal of Brexit. It will demand scrapping tuition fees, restoring further education, opening up higher education much more to entrants from workplaces, scrapping GCSE and SATSs, turning education from an exam factory credential chasing business into human expansion. It will demand much more on green conversion than the £28 billion plan. Public ownership of the whole energy industry, a rundown of North Sea oil and gas on the just transition path outlined in the union-backed Our Power report, a switch to renewables and nuclear, electrification of everything, large and rapid expansion of the electricity grid, the first bottleneck at present to feeding in power from renewables, expansion of rail and rail freight, insulation and heating on conversion to heat pumps of housing, building of new, denser, energy-efficient sharing facilities housing. The energy industry needs public ownership and democratic control. So do all the other utilities, rail, Royal Mail, water. Workers' control at workplace level in all this. To even begin winning that, we'll need a transformed labour movement, unions which organise the unorganised and where officials operate on workers' wages and under democratic control of a competent membership, a Labour Party where we win regular democratic control by the unions and local Labour parties. The fight for a workers' government is not only, not even primarily, a business of writing wish lists. The fight for each demand is also a fight to transform the labour movement by making it able to win that demand. Moves. A government which moves some distance along that road will face flight of capital, as the Mitterrand government in France did in the early 1980s, or the Swedish Social Democrats around 1990, or constitutional sabotage like the Whitlam Labour government in Australia, sacked by the government's general in 1975, or even counter-revolution by armed forces, as happened in Chile in 1973 and was threatened by some officers in Britain in 1974. The Labour movement will have to win public ownership and democratic control over the whole of high finance, thus recouping a large part of the £100 billion a year currently paid out as interest on government's IOUs, and gaining the capacity for democratic control of investment allocation. It will have to organise its own self-defence groups and press for the replacement of the professional army by a democratic citizens' militia. In a closely entwined capitalist world, radical economic measures really will prosper only if extended on at least a continental scale. The demands are not to be thought of as a list, rather a chain or web of ideas with a movement which grows in strength, being able to escalate from each one to others in a crisscross pattern. The idea here is what the Marxists of 100 years ago called transitional demands. We do not stop at what seems realistic now as what the labour movement, with some efforts, might wring out of a Starmer government, nor, on the other side, do we construct an ideal list of what we want done after the revolution. We are, so to speak, among the lower rungs of the chain now. As we go on, the jobs of Marxists, as Lenin put it, is, quote, at each particular moment to find the particular link in the chain which you might grasp with all your might, to prepare firmly for the transition to the next link, end quotes. Only very approximately can we even predict the starting links. Those depend on how, where, on what occasions workers stir into struggle. Commenting a programme of the French Workers' Party, Marx wrote that it, quotes, solely of demands that actually have spontaneously arisen out of the labour movement itself, end quotes. Letter to Sergei, 5 November 1880. Spontaneous here is, of course, relative. Whenever a demand appears, someone must first have voiced it. The point is that Marxists listen to the labour movement. We listen for the demands which express its best impulses and hopes and develop them. we are also the memory of the class. We remember, by studying history, the demands which have emerged as most fruitful in analogous situations in the past. We don't always have to wait until someone else suggests them anew. We need a workers' governments because only by working class struggle can the blight of capitalism be lifted. A government cannot become a workers' government by anointment or decree. It has to be made a workers' government through stages of struggle. We do not wait for workers' governments to do things for us. The question is what we can do at first to force concessions, even from a self-proclaimed pro-business government, and then as fast as we can, as patiently as we need to, transform the labour movement to enable it to generate a whole different sort of government. Solidarity 704. Solidarity 704 will be out on the 3rd of April, not 27th of March, because it's difficult to get good paper distribution across the Easter weekend. This issue, Solidarity 703, would normally have been out on the 13th of March, but we had to skip a week because of multiple staff illnesses. Page 3. Standing Together and Gaza by Ira Bekovic. On 7th and the 13th of March, the left-wing social movement Standing Together organised different action aids convoys, bringing food and other essential supplies donated by Jewish and Palestinian citizens of Israel to the Kerem Shalom Gaza border crossing. On both occasions, the convoys were blocked by police and the military. Standing Together activists had expected to be blocked. Their action was principally symbolic, aimed at raising the profile inside Israel of the intense humanitarian crisis facing the people of Gaza and adding to the atmosphere of pressure on the Israeli state to address it. Standing Together said, quotes, "The police and the army are continuing to not let us get to the border with Gaza with our aid convoy, despite allowing extremists protesting against aid coming into Gaza to reach the border over the past few weeks. We must resist starvation and the collective punishment of a civilian population and say no to an endless war." End quotes. These convoys are symbolic so far, with less immediate effect than diplomatic pressure. But a movement built from such symbolic actions today can be decisive long term. The USA has increased its own aid provision operations, coordinating airdrops with the Jordanian Air Force and announcing plans to construct a temporary port for aid deliveries via sea. Under substantial American and international pressure, Israel has now claimed it is trying to flood Gaza with humanitarian aid. It says it will open up new crossings on the Gaza border. Where global anti-war movements and mobilizations in solidarity with the Palestinians place demands directly on the USA and other governments, they generally take the form of demanding governments support calls for a ceasefire and withdraw military aid to Israel rather than focusing on the provision of aid. But the USA and other powers could do more, much more, to increase the provision of aid even further. Solidarity movements should demand they do so. Demanding our and other governments' supports calls for a ceasefire remains vital. Although few states now say they oppose a ceasefire, the US has continued to use its UN Security Council veto to block the adoption of an unambiguous pro-ceasefire position there. The call for the USA to withdraw military aid to Israel is also important and necessary. The left should, though, be clear about the limits of that demand, even if it were to be won. It is not a cure-all. It is not a substitute for solidarity with mobilizations on the ground for peace, mutual recognition, and democratic settlement, two states, and workers' unity. One of many contradictory aspects of how much of the far left thinks about Israel is that it is often presented as far more powerful than it actually is, with Zionists internationally seen as controlling the foreign policy of other countries, but equally often as a mere client or even a semi-colony of the USA, simply doing America's bidding and able to carry out its military actions only thanks to American aid. Israel is not doing America's bidding now. The regional and global instability caused by Israel's war in Gaza and its still live risk of spreading to wider war are by no means in the interests of US imperialism. Also, Israel is not is a net exporter of arms. Its military is not immediately reliant on US aid or supplies. Even a total arms embargo by the US, whilst an important gesture, would not prevent Israel from prosecuting its war. Such an embargo would be a diplomatic statement, even if an important one. Writing in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, journalist Anshel Pfeffer says that America could, quote, delay the supply of F-35s, fighter jets, of which the Israel Air Force has 50 on order, with about half a dozen not yet delivered. These are big-ticket items, and keeping them back is a big statement. But it would have little, if any, impact on the war in Gaza, where the stealth fighters are hardly an essential weapon system for attacking Hamas, which doesn't have much in the way of anti-aircraft defences that the F-35 was designed to evade. At the most, withholding the last batch of F-35s would cause some problems in the IAF's training and maintenance schedules, end quotes. FIFA recalls that the USA imposed an arms embargo on Israel in 1981 when Ronald Reagan's administration suspended delivery of F-16 fighter jets to Israel after an Israeli raid on a nuclear reactor in Iraq, which violated the airspace of US allies Jordan and Saudi Arabia. Reagan also restricted military aid to Israel in an attempt to pressure it to withdraw its troops from Beirut and Lebanon. Those US actions did not stop Israel making war in Lebanon. It does not follow that all such measures are irrelevant. It was US pressure which pushed Israel to withdraw from Sinai in 1957-58 and again in 1979-82. However, a sober assessment of Israel's military capability suggests that international air anti-war and solidarity movements should focus more on solidarity with the anti-war and anti-occupation left, made up of both Palestinians and Jews within Israel. Sharpening social and political struggle within Israel itself may contribute more to the collapse of the Netanyahu regime than increased international diplomatic pressure. On 9th of March, a speaker at a large anti-Netanyahu protest in Tel Aviv said, quotes, "Nothing interests Bibi Netanyahu, not the hostages, not the evacuees, not the starving Palestinians in Gaza. Only Bibi interests Bibi," end quotes. Thus far, the mainstream anti-Netanyahu and anti-government protests have tended not to address the question of Israel's treatment of the Palestinians. For a speaker to name the issue as a sign of small but important progress for efforts by standing together and others to persuade anti-Netanyahu protesters to join the dots between Netanyahu's domestic policies and Israel's occupation and wars. Veteran Israeli leftist Adam Keller, interviewed recently in Solidarity, once ran a bulletin entitled "The Other Israel." Part of Keller's aim was to show the international left that Israeli society was not a monolith, that it was itself a site of struggle, that there were Israelis resisting the wars, occupation and racism of the state. There are few more direct symbols of these struggles today than the contrasting images of action by Israeli citizens around the Gaza border. The far-right settlers who mobilised to attempt to blockade, and the left-wing solidarity activists who mobilised to attempt to provide it. The Palestinians are an oppressed people, and they have a right to resist that oppression, whatever the level of support they have in Israeli society at a given time. No principle obliges them to wait for Israeli support before they demand fundamental rights of self-determination and equality. But in fact, the prospect of success for such struggles will be greatly increased if the Palestinians can mobilize the support of Israeli allies. The segment of the Palestinian people most free to act politically and most able to wield political economic leverage is, paradoxically, the Palestinian population within Israel and East Jerusalem. The hope for a future based on equality and democracy in the region therefore rests substantially on whether the other Israel represented by movements like Standing Together, currently a small minority, can make itself hegemonic. UK Friends of Standing Together. Standing Together, Israel's fastest growing grassroots movement over recent years, unites Jews and Palestinians within Israel to fight for an equal and just society, for peace and against the occupation. UK FOST promotes their work in the UK for peace, justice and equality for Israelis and Palestinians, Jews and Arabs, including an equal right to self-determination and for the full equality of Palestinian citizens of Israel. UK FOST promotes the benefits of joint struggle by Jews and Palestinians to this end. Upcoming meetings. Workers' Liberty meetings are open to all and are online. Upcoming meetings include Thursday, the 21st of March, 3 p.m., a tube worker meeting, 40 years after the miners' strike. Thursday, 26th of March, 6:30 p.m., Do We Need a Revolution? Thursday, Do We Need a Revolution in Newcastle? Thursday, the 28th of March, 7 p.m., James Connolly and the 1916 Easter Rising in Liverpool. Thursday, 11th of April, 8 p.m., Theses on Feuerbach Study Group, Zoom. For details, see workersliberty.org-events. Page 4, Textile Workers Strike in Egypt, by Eric Lee, founder editor of Labour Start, writing here in a personal opinion column. The 3,700 female workers in the Mahalla textile factories were furious. The Egyptian president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, had earlier in the month raised the minimum wage to 6,000 Egyptian pounds, the equivalent of just £100. That's £100 per month. But workers in the state-owned companies, including Mahalla, were exempted from the pay increase. The decision by the el-Sisi government to raise wages was due to the increasingly severe cost of living crisis in the country. In January 2024, the government raised prices of electricity, metro tickets and telecommunication services in an attempt to get a grip on the growing budget deficit. The efforts were praised, as one would expect, by the International Monetary Fund. The women at Mahalla decided to go on strike. Their initial demand was to be given the same pay as every other worker in the country. They took their protest to a Ramadan expo, which was extended by the regional government's governor, Dr. Tariq Rami. They shouted slogans at him, forcing him to flee the area. Workers were later prevented from leaving the factory locked behind the gates. When news of this got out, workers from other factories joined the women on strike. The strike was spreading. As peaceful protests continued, both Mahalla's management and the Egyptian government refused to negotiate. Eventually, the minister in charge of the public sector companies agreed to raise the minimum wage to that just granted to the private sector workers. But by then, the workers' demands had grown. They wanted, among other things, a meal allowance equal to £15. Nevertheless, the strike ended on the 29th of February, but then the dispute turned nasty. 13 workers were arrested by the security services, two of whom remain in custody, Wael Mohamed Mahmoud Abu Zayed and Mohamed Mahmoud Talba Hussein. And incredibly, some of those workers were threatened with dismissal for being absent from work at a time when they were in police custody. The Centre for Trade Unions and Workers' Services, CTUWS, which has been campaigning in support of Egypt's independent trade union since its founding in 1990, has launched a campaign on Labour Start. The campaign calls on the company's management to release the two workers still in custody, stop further arrests and false charges against workers. The CTUWS points out that the actions of the company and the government are in breach of the International Labour Organization's conventions, to which Egypt is a signatory. The campaign can be found on BTLYCTUWS and deserves wide support in the British and international labour movements. Singer with a Tin Ear, Antidoto by Jim Denham. The singer Charlotte Church seems to be a very well-meaning person, probably a pacifist, with a record of support for a range of progressive and humanitarian causes. At the end of February, she took part in a concert at the Bedwas Workmen's Hall near Kefili to raise money for the Middle East Children's Alliance, an aid organization which supports children in Gaza. So far, so good. However, in the course of the concert, Miss Church led a choir in a rendition of a song containing the lyrics, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," a reference to the land between the Jordan River on the eastern border of the West Bank and Israel, and the Mediterranean Sea to the west. It is a slogan that has long been used on pro-Palestinian demos, but is regarded by many Jews and others as a call for the total destruction of Israel. A look at a map will tell you why. The campaign against anti-Semitism said the singer was, quotes, at best tone, deaf, and at worst, using her voice to fan the flames of hatred. Various far-right figures, notably Nigel Farage, a man with a record of promoting anti-Semitic tropes, jumped aboard the anti-church bandwagon, and she says her safety and her family's has been threatened. Threats against Ms. Church and her family are clearly completely unacceptable and have rightly been reported to the police. Ms. Church responded with a lengthy 10 March article on her own website, which complained about the, quotes, liberal legacy media outlets, including BBC News, end quotes, allegedly not explaining that the song was sung at a charity event for Gaza children. In fact, the BBC News, The Guardian and The Independent all went into some detail about this and states, quotes, "I do not believe that the phrase, from the river to the sea, is in any way a call for ethnic cleansing or genocide of Israelis, and certainly when I've used it or heard it used by the people, it has always been a call for the liberation of Palestine. That is the most face value of interpretation. Often it is accompanied by the phrase, we are all Palestinians," end quotes. Later on in her article, she complains about the fact that The Guardian and BBC News headlined her denial of anti-Semitism, and then complains that there has been, quotes, no mention of the actual history of the usage of the phrase. just incredibly irresponsible journalism, end quotes. In fact, the Guardian carried a quite detailed and reasonably accurate article on the history of the slogan. All of this might seem something of a storm in a teacup, but the prominence of the River to the Sea slogan, especially promoted by the SWP on Gaza ceasefire demos, makes a discussion unavoidable. The Guardian's history of the chant describes it as being, quote, open to an array of interpretations from the genocidal to the democratic, end quotes. Last November, Solidarity paraphrased a labour activist, a supporter of ceasefire and someone who has worked in the West Bank, quotes, some may first think it's a bland freedom everywhere call. By now they must know that most Jews see it as threatening, as meaning Arab or Islamic rule in all of 1918 to 48 Palestine and the wiping out of Israel. So use a different slogan unless you want to make the threat or don't care, end quotes. The Communist Party of Britain's Morning Star, 13th of October 2023, carried an article by the paper's editor, Ben Checo, stating that the slogan, quotes, has long been controversial on the left because of its implied backing for a single state, with organisations like the Communist Party always having advised members not to chant it, end quotes. On 12th of March, however, the Morning Star used two full pages to republish Ms. Church's Mother Day justification of the slogan. Perhaps the Communist Party's advice against using it has now just withered away. Page 5. Young Men Drifting to the Right, Women's Fight Back by Katie Toller. Young men are drifting to the right on many issues, while young women move left. At least that is what recent studies suggest. Polling data reported in The Economist from 20 countries indicates that 20 years ago there was little difference between the share of men and women aged 18 to 29 who described themselves as liberal rather than conservative. But now the gap has grown to 25 percentage points. In the UK, King College London's Policy Institute and Global Institute for Women's Leadership in partnership with Ipsos UK have found the gender split in views is starkest among the young when it comes to how helpful the term toxic masculinity is, whether it's harder to be a man than a woman today, whether feminism has done more good or harm to society, and approval of misogynist influencer Andrew Tate. Young men are notably less positive than young women about the impact of feminism. Overall, 43% feminism has done more good to society than harm, while only 12% think it has done more harm than good. Among those aged 16 to 29, 46% of women think feminism has done more good to society than harm, 10 percentage points higher than their share of young men who feel this way, 36%. Within that age group, 1 in 6, 16% men say feminism has done more harm than good compared with 1 in 11, 9% women. Young men are still generally more socially progressive than older men, but now they are no more likely than older men to think equal opportunities for women should go further. 13% of the whole UK public say attempts to give equal opportunities to women have gone too far. A much greater share, 46%, say they've not gone far enough. A third, 36%, say these attempts have made about the right amount of progress already. Men, 17%, are around twice as likely as women, 8%, say efforts to support women's equality have gone too far. As to thinking efforts to bring equal opportunities have not gone far enough, the youngest men surveyed, 36%, are less likely than the oldest, 37%, to hold this view. Polls from 27 European countries found that men under 30 were more likely than those over 65 to agree that advancing women's and girls' rights has gone too far because it threatens men's and boys' opportunities, end quotes. Young women are likely to believe the opposite. Similar results can be found in South Korea and China. Hungary's president forced to resign by Ferenc Fejes. A series of protests starting on the 9th of February has rocked Hungary, forcing the resignation of President Katalin Novak the very next day, along with the Minister of Justice, Judith Varga. The catalyst of the demonstrations was the revelation that the president pardoned the deputy director of an orphanage in Bicske, Andriy K., who was found guilty of covering up sexual abuse committed by the director, Janos V., against children in their care. Andriy K. also forced children to write and sign statements denying accusations they had made against the principal. While the pardon was signed last May, on the day of the Pope's visit to Hungary, its existence only came to light on the 2nd of February after the news site 444HU published an article on its discovery. Unsurprisingly, presidential pardons aren't widely publicised, and this one only came to light because it was referred to in response to one of the perpetrators' previously filed appeal. The first demonstration on the 9th of February was organised by the National Commonweal Student Movement in front of the Ministry of Interior. It later merged with another demonstration organised by Momentum, a small liberal party. The other opposition parties also took part, although Anna Oroz, one of the organisers, asked people to lower their party flags. 50,000. Anna Donath, the president of Momentum, asked people to demonstrate every day until Katalin Novak stepped down. The next day, she did exactly that. After being dragged back ahead of schedule from a visit to Qatar, she announced her resignation. People, however, were not satisfied. On 16th of February, about 50,000 people demonstrated. Unfortunately, it was mostly, although not completely, apolitical, apart from the clear distaste towards the ruling party, Fidesz and Prime Minister Orban. The people behind it were influencers on the social media with no prior experience in organising protests. They called for an investigation into who knew about the pardon, talked about the horrible states of orphanages, hospitals, maternity wards and schools, areas where the government's rhetoric on protecting children does not match reality. As the demonstration started, news came out that Sultan Belog, a bishop of the Reformed Church, had resigned as the synodal president after it came to light that he lobbied Katalin Novak to pardon Andriy K. However, as of the writing of this article, he remains a bishop. The episode was naturally awkward for Orban and Fidesz, given how they have postured as the defenders of the family from dangers real or imagined. After years of smearing LGBTQ people as potential groomers and paedophiles, one of their own pardons, someone who protected a child rapist. Of course, that wasn't her real sin. Her sin was getting caught doing it and embarrassing the government. That is why she had to go. Opinion polls show little decline for Fidesz and little gain for opposition parties. The next parliamentary election is not due until 2026. There still isn't a political force in Hungary that's powerful enough to challenge Orban, and neither will be there as long as bourgeois neoliberals and careerists dominate the political field. the socialist group Sika is working to develop a new alternative. Activist agenda. The Workers Against CCP Repression campaign has scheduled protests at Apple stores for 2 p.m. on the second Sunday of every month. Next is 2 p.m. 14th of April at the Apple stores at 128 New St. Birmingham and New Street, Birmingham, and at Covent Garden in London. The protests demand end Uyghur forced labour in Apple supply chains, end Apple's collaboration with CCP censorship, union rights for factory workers in China, decent conditions and union recognition for UK Apple workers. Page 6. Vote Steve for NUS VPHE by Workers' Liberty students. Workers' Liberty activist Steve Chapman is standing for Vice President Higher Education VPHE in the National Union of Students, NUS. Steve's campaign is an attempt to unite the student left around central demands to return democracy and action to the NUS and to connect the students and workers' movements in the UK, particularly in higher education. Free education, no cuts, no debt. Since the introduction of tuition fees in the UK, and especially since their trebling in 2010, the demand for free education has been a central pillar in the student movement. As the student movement itself has waned, the demand has become weaker. Demonstrations call for free education are no longer a regular fixture on campuses. The NUS has passed contradictory policy, which is a barrier to effective action. Starmer and Reeves have said they will drop Labour's commitment to scrap tuition fees. Our demand is clear. Education must be free at all levels and all ages, funded by taxing the rich. Because education benefits all of us, the cost should be borne by those who have the means to pay for it. This means fighting against tuition fees, but also against course closures and job cuts in higher education, as we are currently seeing play out at universities across the country, including Goldsmiths, Northumbria and Oxford, Brookes. For any of these fights to win, the student movement needs to get behind them. Organise. Participation in the NUS and in its constituents, student unions, has fallen considerably over the last few years. The student movement and the broader left that those students go on to be part of needs more than a few activists calling demonstrations and meetings with all the same few faces. Part of the blame here lies with the NUS. Since changes at multiple national conferences, the democratic structures of the union are not fit for purpose. Decisions are increasingly left in the hands of the full-time staff, with elected positions as student activists beholden to the organisation's poor democracy and a strategy based on NGO-style diplomatic influence. We must fight for an NUS that can respond appropriately to an increasingly desperate situation for students across the country. Workers' Liberty students, if you are a delegate to NUS Conference 2024, 17th to 18th of April, vote Steve Chapman for VPHE and make sure that these demands are heard at the national level. But these demands cannot be met by one person getting elected. Workers' Liberty students want to see a revival of participation in student politics and a grassroots movement for education as a basic right. If that sounds good to you, then get in contact with us and see what activity we can do together on your campus. SRN, Research Now, but More Only Under Socialism, debate by Stuart Jordan. If the workers' movement does emerge as a governing power in the next few decades, then it is likely to inherit a planet that is already deep into escalating climate chaos. To rule out SRM or any other technological innovation that might elevate human suffering would be foolish. We have an interest in maximizing our knowledge of these technologies, to better understand the risks and the obstacles to controlling those risks. On this basis, we are broadly in favour of any research that expands our understanding and its knowledge. However, I think Paul Vodensky, Solitary 693, underplays the dangers of a capitalist-led solar radiation management program, is overly impressed by the claims of for-hire eco-modernist scientists, and is too pessimistic about the prospects for socialism. Paul is right to note that David Keith and Ken Caldiera are doing a job for billionaire Bill Gates. He could have added that they have made their careers in university departments funded and to some extent controlled by fossil capital, and have made small fortunes in private ventures with multinational oil and coal corporations. These facts alone do not necessarily discredit their scientific work, but we should be aware. Keith is one of the primary signatories of the Eco-Modernist Manifesto, and his political outlook is deeply conservative. He believes ecological challenges can be fixed through technological means alone with no social change. With his assertion that, quotes, working class power is not on the immediate horizon, end quotes, Paul also suggests social changes is unlikely and arrives at similar conclusions to Keith on SRM. But SRM is not on the immediate horizon either. SRM is at best a project for decades in the future, at a time when the climate crisis is so extreme that we have run out of alternatives. Few socialists think international workers' revolution will happen within the next weeks or years, but the next few decades. Socialism is a more immediate prospect than SRM. To paraphrase Marx, there are decades when nothing happens and, quotes, days in which 20 years are embodied, end quotes. The problem is that Keith's research plan bleeds into actual implementation. We haven't got a test planet that we can research on before we start implementation on planet Earth. The final phases of Keith's research proposal may take us past the point of no return, where concerns about termination shock may mean we are already committed. We should be in favour of using modern computing power to model SRM scenarios, but modelling is only as good as the data we input. NASA scientist Chris Kollos has criticised Keith and his colleagues for the simplicity of their modelling and the grand claims they made for their results. Many other climatologists have criticised their techno-optimism. Paul, however, seems to think it is a shame that research is mired in theory and lab work and, like Keith, wants to press on with real-world experiments. Why the rush? Better modelling from publicly funded scientific institutions precedes real-world experimentation. Paul notes governance problems with SRM, but argues that with a nudge from the workers' movement, capitalist states can be persuaded to collaborate. He downplays the potential for SRM to be used in, or as a justification for, military conflicts. But we can expect competing capitalist states with a record of utter failure in climate change to collaborate over the many decades, possibly centuries, on a project that will almost certainly affect regional weather patterns. We should have no such illusions. Competing capitalist states are extremely volatile and will try and use SRM to their own nationalist advantage, maybe radically destabilizing Earth's climate with SRM. Only a democratic socialist commonwealth would have the stability and legitimacy to run an SRM program as part of a broader multi-generational plan to restabilize the climate. To limit the workers' movement to the role of guarantor that bourgeois states stick to their promises and get consent for planet interventions is to sow illusions in the rationality and stability of bourgeois rule. Page 7. Unrest Rises in Iran by Dan Katz. Quotes, the one that knocks on the door at night has come to kill the light, end quotes, Elrizeh Ghorbani, Strange Times. Kazım Nikkar from the Iranian Workers' Rights campaign, Free Them Now, believes that there are at least 10 worker protests and strikes each day in Iran, particularly in street petrochemicals, oil and gas production. On 9th of March, nurses and medics from the hospitals in the large city of Shiraz demonstrated against low pay and unpaid wages. The next day, nurses protested at Bushehr, complaining that their salaries are too low and that they were being forced to work extra overtime. Nurses chanted, quotes, "We don't want forced work, we are not doing it," end quotes. Nurses in Iran are often paid under the equivalent of $3 for each hour of overtime. In the southern town of Carnoug, many nurses announced their resignation en masse. Iran has a shortfall of 70,000 nurses and 3,000 are leaving Iran each year. In May 2023, an official report stated that 10,000 medical staff emigrated in the previous year. Most cite poor wages and living conditions as the reasons for leaving. Inflation has been running at 50% per year for 5 years, and food prices are rising at over 100%. In the last year, the riel has lost one-third of its value against the US dollar. The minimum wage is due to be reset, and the ultra-right-wing Islamist government seems determined to only increase the minimum salary by 20% to 150 million Iranian riels, around $190. At least half Iran's population is living in poverty, with workers often struggling to pay rents, which are especially high in the capital, Tehran. The increasingly isolated clerical regime has heavily repressed all opposition. Education International has called for the release of 14 jailed leaders of the Coordinating Council of the Iranian Teacher Trade Association, statement, 28th of February. During the mass protest movements following the murder of Mahsa Jina Amini by the Iranian Morality Police in September 2022, over 22,000 people were arrested and 550 killed. Iran executed at least 834 people in 2023, including 167, or 20% of the total, from the Baluch minority in southeast Iran. Baluchis make up 5% of the overall population. 7 executions were carried out in public. Iran continues to use amputation and whipping as punishments. A German opinion poll, December 2023, of 158,000 people in Iran suggests an overwhelming majority, 81%, reject the regime, preferring a democratic state. A recent government survey leaked to BBC Persian also suggests that 73% of Iranians support the separation of religion and state. Ultra-conservative Islamists dominate the new pseudo-parliament and the Advisory Garden Council, having rigged the poll by preventing even mildly critical Islamists from standing as candidates. Those barred from standing included former presidents Hassan Rouhani and Mohammad Khatami. Official polling figures put the turnout at 41% at the 1st March election, a record low. Polling was particularly low in Tehran, where 16 seats from 30 remained unfilled as candidates failed to reach the 20% threshold. Portugal, Fading Memories of Fascism by Tom Harrison. Constant secret police surveillance, arbitrary arrests and assassinations, violent repression of political protests, absence of free trade unions and meaningful elections, censorship of the press, books, radio and TV, systematic torture of opponents, island camps for political dissidents, all feature of a right-wing regime that was swept away 50 years ago in Portugal in the Carnation Revolution. A half century on, the collective memory of the dictatorship seems to have faded, as many Portuguese cast votes for the far-right Chega party in the 10th March parliamentary election. The figure of António Seleza, who ran the quasi-fascist dictatorship for most of its time from 1926 to 1974, loomed large in Portuguese politics of the last 100 years. When the public broadcaster RTP did a series on the greatest Portuguese in 2007, Salazar came top with over 40% of the votes, after complaints about the skewing of choice in the poll were taken into account. However, his score went down to between 6 and 11%. Most of Portugal's present-day electorates are too young to have lived through the Salazar dictatorship and unlikely to be experiencing some kind of suade de melancholic or nostalgic longing for a return to it. Nevertheless, the political stance of Chega bears all the hallmarks of such a political program. It uses a version of the Salazarist motto, Deus Patria Familia, God, Fatherland, Family. Chega is led by André Ventura, another reactionary scumbag who, in the footsteps of Trump, Milei and Zemmour, managed to beguile the gullible by being a TV personality. Chega's ideology is anti-immigrant, anti-women and anti-LGBTQ+, anti-Muslim, Eurosceptic and conspiracy theorist. It particularly singles out the most persecuted of minority communities in Europe, the Romani. The ascent of Chega to the political mainstream began in 2019 when Ventura gained a seat in the Portuguese parliament. In 2022, they went up to 12 seats. Now they are on 48, potentially determining the country's government. Part of the cause is a major disengagement from the political process since 1974. In the heady days of the revolutionary period, the first legislative assembly election had a turnout of over 80%. In the two elections of 2019 and 2022, turnout scraped above 50%. The election on 10th of March saw a significant increase in turnout to 66%. It is difficult to say, but a significant proportion of Chega's tally was probably made up of previously missing voters. The traditional conservative vote, Democratic Alliance, was pretty much static, but Chega's 36-seat gain almost equaled the loss of 40 suffered by the Socialist Party, PS. The Left Bloc, an alliance of leftist groups, held on to its 5 seats, but is still well below its heyday a decade ago, with over 500,000 votes and 19 seats in Parliament. The second general election in 2 years was provoked by a corruption scandal alleged to have implicated members of the PS government. Low wages and stretched public services increased voter discontent, further compounded by a serious housing crisis. Lisbon has become a go-to place for digital nomads who, since the COVID lockdowns, realize they can work remotely, indeed keep a global city job while moving to a warmer climate with relatively cheap housing costs. The effect was to force up property prices by over 30% in the last 5 years, so housing in Lisbon has ended up more expensive than Milan, Madrid or Berlin. Liberalisation of the rental market has also made it near impossible for working class people to afford a decent place to live and bring up a family. Chega has nothing to offer in the way of solutions to the material issues suffered by the working class. Like some others on today's far right, it offers little of the corporatist and welfarist element of old-style fascism. Instead, Jager favours the libertarian roll-back-the-state mantra, yet cuts in state spending and economic regulation will increase poverty and unemployment. As for Jager's clean-up promise, they'll doubtless be equally corrupt should they go into office. Should Jager become a government, they'll be following the Orban path of illiberal democracy and making sure they stay in power for a good long time, maybe for as long as Salazar did. The pursuit of neoliberal economic policies and austerity by the PS and other supposedly left-wing governments is a major reason why disillusioned voters have turned to the far right in Portugal and elsewhere. It is the task of the socialist movement to develop a credible alternative which combats the advance of the force of the reaction and achieves a just society. Pages 8 and 9. Plekhanov, as the father of Russian Marxism, The Road to Bolshevism by Sean McGammer, seventh in a series of articles on the 100th anniversary of the death of Vladimir Ulyanov Lenin in 1924. Timeline. June 1879, the revolutionary populist group Zemla Elvelvia, Land and Freedom, splits. The majority forms Narodnaya Volya, NV, People's Will. Plekhanov leads the minority. Chorny Peretel, BR, Black Redistribution. 1879-81. Black redistribution never really gets going. Plekhanov and his close comrades flee to exile in Switzerland. NV gains support. March 1881, NV kills Tsar Alexander II, the liberator who had freed the serfs. The new Tsar is markedly more illiberal than his father was. The result is not democratic reform, but increased repression, which quells NV and the incipient workers' movements too. April 1881, the beginning of large-scale anti-Semitic pogroms and the movements west of Russian Jews. NV welcomes the pogroms as a manifestation of the people, BR criticizes NV. September 1883, Plekhanov and his comrades found the Group for the Emancipation of Labour in exile. Early 1885, Plekhanov publishes his major book, Our Differences. 1891, famine in Russia Empire. The movement in society to deal with it is the turning of the tide for the recovery of society from the repression that followed the killing of the Tsar in 1881. Early 1890s, workers' movement in Russia and Marxist groups on Plekhanov's lines appear after a decade of isolation for Plekhanov and his comrades. 1894, On Agitation by Julius Martov and Arkady Kremer appears. Black Completely Redistribution was formed by the minority that seceded from Russia's revolutionary populist movement, Zemlya A Volya, CIV, Land and Freedom, in June 1879. The majority formed Narodnaya Volya, People's Will. Those who resisted the majority's turn formed Black Redistribution. The Black Redistribution people would be the future Western European type Marxists, but in 1879 they continued as Tsiev was Bakunist. Against the new majority and envied line of terrorism, assassination of top Tsarist officials, not as terrorism often means now, of innocent people, to back up the new political demands on the Tsar for a constitution and an amnesty for all political prisoners. Black Redistribution wanted to continue preaching immediate socialism and immediate peasant or workers' revolt. But the mass peasant revolt strategy had failed resoundingly. The majority which formed Narodnaya Volya had faced up to that and decided to go political with an immediate push for a constitution to be won by the direct action of a necessarily small band of heroes doing combat above society with the Tsarist state officials and the Tsar. The people had not answered the revolutionaries' call, so they had to do without them. The Narodniks' idea of socialism is something that already existed in the peasant society, the Maya, needing only to slough off the absolute monarchy, the landlords and the bureaucracy, had not gained wide support, so they concluded that socialism was not necessary immediately. But a political movement was. A constituent assembly would do. We don't need politics, the old approach had said. And Narodnaya Volya replied, Bakunin was wrong. They needed politics, remaking the Russian state, a constituent assembly. Black redistribution, led by Georgi Plekhanov, turned out to be an organization in transition and soon scarcely existing between ZIV and the Group for the Emancipation of Labour, which Plekhanov founded in September 1883. BR backed and applauded what Narodnaya Volya did. They wanted a mass movement, not the now almost exclusive envy focus on individual terror. But they committed themselves in the 1879 split to critically support envy's deeds, and they honoured that commitment. Mass terror was the alternative which West European revolutionary socialists counterposed to individual terrorism. Zinoviev invokes it, perhaps demagogically. Black redistribution, BR, saw politics as having no useful connection with the communist revolution they sought. Plekhanov and his comrades, Paul Axelrod, Vera Zasaluch, and others, would become Russia's first consistent and comprehensive Marxists. They evolved between their break with the majority of Zemlya Volya in June 1879 and the foundation of the Group for the Emancipation of Labour on the 12th of September 1883. BR urged for the wage workers' emancipation, such as the peasants had in 1861. Land redistribution was the one issue in which Zemlya Volya had evoked a response from the peasants. But very few joined BR. It declared itself the continuation of the old revolutionary populism, that is, the same thing as that had already shown in its inadequacy to most of its former adherents. Narodnaya Volya's turn to terrorism and the call for a constitution had come from that failure. What was new was the turn to the politics of demanding a constituent assembly. That was what BR rejected. The widespread story that BR split against terrorism as such is simply not true. Wait. The failure of ZIV hung as a dead weight around Plekhanov's neck, but he wanted to stick with its strategy. Now there was the active competition against BR, NV, glamour attached to the deeds of terrorism which black redistribution supported and praised but did not itself do. The turn to politics was necessary in a country without a parliament, without the right to free speech, free organisation, free assembly, a free press, or the liberty of the person, where official politics was never more than intrigues at the Tsarist court. Terror was the only form of radical politics in the tradition of the old populists that was available. It is a measure of how far Plekhanov had yet to travel that he would come to regard the programme embodied in the very name of black complete redistribution as socially and economically regressive and reactionary. Why? Because it implied levelling down and undoing large-scale capitalist farming, which it had emerged and replaced it with solely peasant cultivation. Georgi Plekhanov, 23 years old, walking away from the Voronezh Congress of the ZIV in June 1879, was not yet a consistent, or at least not a Western-style Marxist. He walked away from Voronezh not as someone breaking with his previous ideas or advocating a break with them, but as their defender against the majority at the ZIV Congress, who were, as Plekhanov's opinion, and in fact breaking with them by turning to the demands for a constitution. He was then no innovator. He was still a conservative populist, an unreconstructed follower of the ideas of Mikhail Bukhanov, which had guided the previous phase of the populist activity. He would later, as a Marxist, define the Bakuninist positions he still held then as species of a utopian socialism. The only difference, he would write, was that the materialist Bakunin transforms the utopian program of the idealist Proudhon into something even more utopian, more nebulous, more absurd, end quotes. The Bakuninists, Plekhanov in 1879, opposed the decision of the ZIV Congress to turn towards systematic terrorism, not because it was terrorism, but because the terrorism was action to back a political demand, constitutional assembly. Plekhanov and his comrades were for the assassination of state officials and members of the ruling class. Indeed, one of them, Vera Zasulich, had been the pioneer of terrorism. Both Zasulich and Axelrod came close to joining Nerad's Naya Lotvolia at more than one point. It is common for writers on the early Russian Marxists to read back onto the earlier periods their attitude 20 years later to the terrorist populist movements as regrouped in 1902 into the Socialist Revolutionary Party, SRs. The Russian Marxists called the SRs the epigenes, the unworthy successors of the early movements created by those from whom Plekhanov had broken in 1879, though they said they gave critical support to them against the Tsarist regime. The group of the for the Emancipation of Labour, GEL, explicitly endorsed the terrorism of Narodnaya Volya. Page 9. The Emancipation of the Emancipation of Labour group at the same time recognises the necessity for terrorist struggles against the absolutist government and differs from the Narodnaya Volya party only on the question of the so-called seizure of power by the Revolutionary Party and the tasks of the immediate activity of the socialists among the working class, end quotes. Here, in early 1884, the GEL was referring to a drift in NV after 1881 to fading out the Constituent Assembly demands and tying the new almost exclusive focus on terrorism to an idea of the seizure of power by a tiny minority coup and then engineering popular assent to socialist policies imposed from above. Why did Marxists come to reject NV-style terrorism? Leon Trotsky was accused in the Moscow trails of being a terrorist in alliance with Nazism. Factually, it was arrant nonsense. Before a commission under John Dewey of investigation into the allegations made in the trials, however, Trotsky discussed the practicalities of terrorism in the terms which Marxists would arrive at by later decades of discussion. Quotes, terrorist work, I wrote in 1909, in its very essence, demands such a concentration of energy upon the supreme movement, such an overestimation of personal heroism, and lastly, such a hermetically concealed conspiracy as excludes completely any agitational and organizational activity among the masses. It is impossible to fool or outwit history, the basic property of terror as a system to destroy that organization which by means of chemical compounds seeks to compensate for its own lack of political strength. There are, of course, historical conditions where terror can introduce confusion among the governing ranks. But in that case, who is it that can reap the fruits? At all events, not the terrorist organization itself, and not the masses behind those whose backs the duel takes place. End quotes. The dialectical paradox is in the fact that Plekhanov moved towards Marxist or Western European socialism by first entrenching himself in the old Bakuninist anti-political populism, the old utopian socialist current in Russia, against those who had drawn political conclusions from the failures of both the movements to go to the people with enlightening education and socialist enlightenment in the mid-1870s, and the ZIV's attempts to rouse the peasants to revolts after 1876. In one sense, Plekhanov was already a Marxist in 1879, but only in a sense he shared with his ZIV opponents. They too accepted economic and historical Marxism, though not without eclectic admixtures. As can be seen in the collected letters of Marx and Engels, Peter Levrov, the inspirer of the revolutionary populists' drive in the mid-1970s to go to the people to educate them and preach socialism in the broader sense, has close and friendly personal relations with Karl Marx. Mikhail Bakunin, the inspirer of Plekhanov and the rebels of Ziv, who tried to rouse the peasants into immediate revolt, had translated into the Communist Manifesto into Russian. In the last phase of a long and politically multifaceted life, Bakunin rejected what he called Marx's state socialism. He wanted socialism from below against what he called socialism from above, meaning Marxist socialism. But Bakunin proclaimed himself not alone an anarchist, but also an agreement with Marxist interpretation of history and economics. Others of broadly populist persuasion would translate Volume 1, 1867 of Capital into Russian as early as 1872. Black Redistribution was a transitional organization between the Bakuninist populism of Zemla Ayvolya and the Marxism of the Emancipation of Labor group. It had explained itself and what it thought was wrong with the political turn. Political overturns never and nowhere could secure the people's economic and political liberty, end quotes. That was the Bakuninist idea on politics. It raised the slogan, quotes, let the workers seize the factory and the peasants the land, end quotes. Black redistribution inherited the lessons of the limited success of Ziv among workers in the big towns, but those would not come into proper forces until the founders of black redistribution had broken with the core beliefs of all the Russian populists. Meanwhile, there were ongoing attempts to reunite Narodnaya Volyas and black redistribution. How was that possible? Between 1879 and 1883, the difference between Narodnaya Volya and black redistribution was not over fundamental theory or the belief that socialism existed in the Maya, that capitalism was encroaching on it, but could be stopped and reversed by sliding off the ruling class. The differences were on what to do about the ruling class and what to replace it. Moreover, Narodnaya and Volya did not repudiate the Narodnik aim of rousing the people. The majority of the 1879 conference pledged that it would, move on to page 10, lean on the people and not the bourgeoisie. They, like the old Ziv and Plekhanov's black redistribution minority, were for killing landlords and local officials in order to rouse the peasants to revolt, as well as terrorism against the central Tsarist state. Presented its terror as a form of agitation and propaganda of the deed. As one of Narodnaya Volya's heroic fighters, Vera Figner, who would spend 25 years in a Tsarist jail, put it, terrorism was, quote, an agitational medium of unprecedented strength, end quotes. Terror was action, an action that the small group could undertake at will, thus seeming to free the revolutionaries from the dead weight of the people, the peasants, who, though central to populist theory, had proved to be immovable and politically inert. And terror was also the line of least resistance in Russian society. I repeat, it was something they could do at will. Large swathes of liberal opinion in the upper classes lauded the populists, saw their blows against tyrants as blows for the political demand that they had in common with the NV terrorists, a constitution. Like all political innovations that proved to be decisive shifts, the Narodnaya Volya at first seemed to incorporate the older movement and merely to add to its more effective methods. That's how the tendency that Vladimir Ilyinov Lenin polemicized against the economists began with the 1894 text of Kremer and Martov urging agitation. NV remained socialists. They were still champions of the socialist village commune against capitalism. Narodnaya Volya's program began, quotes, in our basic conceptions, we are socialists and populists, end quotes. The difference was in their adoption of new means, the focus on individual targets for political assassination. On the other hand, as Vera Figner put it in retrospect, quotes, we were not pursuing the abstract ultimatum objectives of socialist doctrine, but those demands and needs of the populist mind that in the essence included the socialist principle of liberty, end quotes. That would come to be very important. Narodnaya Volya declared that its terrorist activity had as its goals, quotes, the undermining of the fascination of governmental power, the constant demonstration of the possibilities of struggle against the government, the elevation in this way of the revolutionary spirit of the people and its faith in the success of the cause, and finally the formation of forces fit for the accustomed to battle. End quotes. Quotes, the party, Narodnaya Volya declared, must pay attention to the people not less seriously, but its primary task among the people was to prepare in cooperation in the overturn. In view of the oppression of the people, and since by means of special repression the government will be able to restrain the general revolutionary movement for a very long time, the party must assume the preparation of the overturn itself and not wait for a time when the people will be able to get along without it. End quotes. That was the inversion, and with a vengeance, of the old going to the people with socialist enlightenment, and of the call of Zemlya Volya for immediate mass revolt. The policy which black redistribution clung to. Now small bands of heroes would substitute their actions for those of an already unwilling and too repressed people. Something similar spurred the Guevarists in the West and their Foucault theory of the 1960s and 70s. Such movements involve, by way of what they emphasize and concentrate on, and the consequent withering effects on those aspects of themselves that they do not, for now, emphasize or practice. For practical purposes, Narodnaya Volya came in 1879-81 to express only the demands for a bourgeois constitution. It raised the political demand that would serve all the revolutionary tendencies after 1883, except the anarchists. Until early 1918, it was Bolshevik policy too, the convocation of a constituent assembly elected by universal suffrage. Vera Figner summed it up in retrospect in 1925. Quotes, "Terror in and for itself was never the aim of the party. It was a means of defence, self-defence, and was considered a powerful medium of agitation. Regicide entered this category as a detail. Organisational and propagandist activity also went hand in hand with the war of destruction. But," she says, "as the struggle grew more heated, as time passed and one magnificent exploit after another was conceived and executed by us, the former activity among the people grew diminished in their eyes. The countryside receded into the distance. That part of the programme that spoke of the activity in the countryside gradually took on a purely theoretical, rhetorical character." End quotes. In a sense, NV broke with the old utopian socialism and moved towards the bourgeoisie, the embodiment of capitalism. Plekhanov and his comrades broke with utopian socialism and moved towards West European-type Marxism and the Russian working class. Narodnaya Volya's strength was in the fact that where everything else had failed, the small bands of terrorists could succeed, and with the killing of the Tsar in March 1881 succeeded spectacularly. Indeed, also it should have been, according to what their theory of what they did, decisively. But their greatest success, the violent deposing of the Tsar, would also reveal how weak such methods really were against the whole system that they opposed, how little fundamental could be changed by killing leading state personnel and getting them replaced, which was the most that could be achieved by their guns and bombs. In the competition between Narodnaya Volya and Black Redistribution after 1879, immediate success was all and all important. In terms of practical activity, Black Redistribution could do nothing. Its members either fell into inactivity or defected to Narodnaya Volya. There was historical justice in that, because as Plekhanov would later stress, Narodnaya Volya had moved ahead of them in the necessary turn to politics. The killing of the Tsar in 1881 did not unleash mass revolution, as some of them had hoped, or even reform. It unleashed a decade of mass reaction and repression. Six Narodnaya Volya members were condemned for killing the Tsar, two of them women. Five were hanged. The sixth, Gezia Helfman, was held from the gallows so that she could give birth to the baby she was carrying. Immediately afterwards, she died in jail, perhaps with help. After the killing of the Tsar, the executive of Narodnaya Volya wrote an open letter to the new Tsar in which they made only two demands on him. One, general amnesty for all political criminals. Two, the summoning of representatives of the Russian people, quotes, in order to reconsider the existing system of the state and social life. End quotes. Its moderation won it the sympathy of liberal society in Russia and abroad. It was also a measure of how they had moved from the socialist program of Ziv and indeed from their own program. They now, despite what the 1879 program had said about leaning on the people, aligned mostly with their natural political allies, the bourgeoisie and the liberal aristocrats. After 1881, Narodnaya Volya continued to exist and published a journal in exile, but the repression had essentially smashed the group. In all this, black redistribution and its leaders had been politically marginalised. They expressed support for Narodnaya Volya and solidarised with its militants. So, as we saw, did Karl Marx. They moved only slowly onto the new political ground, which they had rejected on principle in 1879, and towards the foundation of the first non-populist, consistent Marxist movement in Russia, the Group for the Emancipation of Labour in 1883. Central to the group's theoretical evolution was the existence of a strong working class movement in Europe after the new and growing working class in Russia. Although politically it was still entwined with the populist movements, the Russian proletariat had already taken action as a distinct class and incipiently as a distinct political force. Notes, five notes. One, this would surely be focused as the Russian bourgeois demand for something like Britain's supplementary revolution, the Glorious Revolution of 1688, after the Civil War period from 1642 to 1649, when the king was beheaded, which gave the bourgeoisie much of what in that age distinguished it once from the old absolutist monarchy, habeas corpus, end of pre-publication censorship, right to free speech, etc. Two, the question of all or most lands to the peasants divided the left socialist revolutionaries in the Bolshevik Party in 1918 and led to the beginning of the Civil War. Three, as we were supportive of the IRA of the 1970s, though we would never have voted to do what they were doing, and sometimes, as with the Belfast Bloody Friday bombings of 21st of July 1972 and the Birmingham pub bombing of 21st of November 1974, had to dissociate pointedly from what they did. They were in rebellion against the artificial partition of Ireland. In Ireland, there was a natural Catholic majority and a natural Protestant minority. The given partition created a second artificial minority, Catholic, in the six counties. We disagreed with the IRA's approach, but living in Britain, we could not make that disagreement the all-determining thing. Four, Heldzepa revived this above-below dichotomy and counterposed socialism from below to the socialism, that is, liberal Stalinism, from above, of Isaac Deutscher and of the Orthodox Trotskyists, who gave critical support to the regimes imposed by the Russian army in the West, Eastern Europe. It thus had a use and was less organically anarchistic. But all revolutions, by definition, are from below, including even the bureaucratic revolutions by the independent Stalinist movement in Yugoslavia, China, Cuba, Vietnam. Five. The Orthodox Trotskyist, influenced by Ted Grant, argued that the reason for the creation of deformed workers' states in Eastern Europe, China, etc., was a spontaneous economic trend. Any human agency would do, not only the Stalinists. Grant thought that what he calls, quotes, the autonomous movements of the productive forces, end quotes, the impatience, so to speak, of the productive forces with what Trotsky called the crisis of leadership had a lot to do with the appearance of what Grant and others called deformed worker states. They thought Syria and Burma had become deformed worker states by the mid-1960s. Page 11. What is Standing Together? The Palestinian Jewish Standing Together movements in Israel explains its work. We are a relatively new organization, but we are proud of how we organize Palestinian and Jewish citizens of Israel to influence and change our society. This is the political context in which we operate. Israeli society is the one we aim to transform. Our activism and grassroots organizing is directed towards this people, talking with people, gaining support for our positions, and activating people politically. We have many partners, locally and abroad, who share our values. What is unique about Standing Together is how we operate. The fact that we work for justice, peace, freedom, and equality for Palestinians inside the very country, creating and maintaining the violent, oppressive regime. The nightmarish war has raged for months now. The unfathomable humanitarian catastrophe in Gaza, the civilian death toll, the horror of Hamas's attack on October 7th, and deep concern for the lives of the hostages. We cannot accept living in this reality. We are working hard to change it. We fight to transform our society because we deeply care for the people around us. We love this land and those who live here. We look with horror at the directions that the governing leaderships push us towards. We all have skin in the game and our loved ones are deeply impacted. Our movement is bi-national, with Palestinian members in Israel, the state in which we have citizenship, is occupying and denying the humanity of our people. The state's declared war on our national identity and is committing atrocities against our relatives in Gaza and West Bank. For us, bringing about foundational change is urgent. It is quite literally a matter of life or death. And for the past few months, even more so. We partnered with more than 30 organizations to mobilize thousands in Tel Aviv and Haifa for a ceasefire agreement. We've repeatedly said in Hebrew and Arabic on the streets, in the press and on social media that only a ceasefire agreement can bring back the hostages alive and stop the killing of innocents in Gaza. We've helped shift opinions and have rallied thousands of this for this cause. We stand by this very basic fact. There are millions of Palestinians in the land. None of them are going anywhere. There are millions of Jews in this land. None of them are going anywhere. And this must be the starting point of any serious discussion. Our recognition of the right of both peoples to safety, dignity, and freedom clashes with the Israeli political establishment, which continues to promote ethnic cleansing, violent military control, incarceration, and the denial of millions of Palestinians of civil rights and sovereignty. When high-ranking politicians in Israel openly state that they favor an apartheid state in which Jews are granted civil rights, but millions of Palestinians should concede to live as stateless subjects under military rule, we must resist together. This is why we are the leading movements on the ground, fighting against the nation-state law and organizing the first protest against this racist legislation in July 2018, where thousands of Jews and Palestinians marched in Tel Aviv. This is why we spent the past year participating in the protests against the judicial overhaul, intervening in the mass demonstrations with a message that says that there cannot be democracy without equality and without ending the occupation. This is why we work to politicize and empower Palestinian youth inside Israel, organizing those left behind the old political structures and who want to realize a better society free from racism, sexism, and homophobia. We train them to become organizers and leaders. This is why we march to the home of Minister Bezalel Smotrich in the streets of the illegal settlement Kedumun, calling for its evacuation. This is why we say in Hebrew and Arabic inside Israel that we reject the settler agenda. We do so because we know that the current reality is not only deeply unjust. The atrocities committed in the last months shake us to our core, but also because it dangerously undermines our safety. If we and our families are to have a secure future, our political reality must change. Our years of campaigning against occupation and injustice are not merely based on abstract morals, but on the concrete interests of the majority in our society. We, as people in Israel, Jewish and Palestinian, don't benefit but lose from the reality of occupation and war and must fight to change it, rather than equating the people in Israel with the establishment at the top, we recognize the deep contradictions between the interests of the majority in our society, Jews and Arabs, secular and religious, Mizrahi and Ashkenazi, and that of the political and economic elites. Therefore, we engage with people from diverse communities in Israel across differences around our shared interests. We are not content with denouncing the injustices and condemning our reality, but work strategically to organize and build power from below to create change. Sides do exist, but it's not all the Jews on one side against all the Palestinians on the other. It is the vast majority of ordinary people, both Jews and Palestinians, against the few who benefit from the status quo. Our ideas are not confined to theory. We are able to build a movement around them. 5,000 Jew paying members, tens of thousands of supporters, 24 local chapters in cities and on campuses, with competent and diverse leaders. As organizers, we know the real test lies in whether we will succeed in building power. Will masses of people align with our strategy? Will we change policy and common sense perceptions? Our movement aims not merely to be right, but to win. Our movement members, after collective discussions and deliberations, democratically adopted a strategy for standing together that aims to build a new majority in our society, one that would allow us to advance peace, equality, and social and climate justice. To do this, we champion the various causes that advance people's interests and improve our lives. We campaign to raise the minimum wage, fight for a Green New Deal, protest for LGBTQ plus rights, women's rights, and against domestic violence, and organize urban youth to achieve affordable housing. So are we a human rights NGO or an anti-war movement? We're not really either of these. Standing together is an attempt to do something new, to create a people's left that can win a majority away from the ideas of the establishment and offer hope. If our values resonate with yours, then let's be partners. New Shifts on Far Right by Harry Sheeran. In late February, the new neo-Nazi National Rebirth Party, NRP, successfully registered with the Electoral Commission. Its leader, Alex Yoburi, dubbed the Hull Hitler for his penchant for dressing like the Nazi dictator, was active in patriotic alternative before leaving last year. The name National Rebirth Party is explicitly fascist, with the aspiration of a nation reborn in a pure state. Patriotic Alternative, PA, and its splinters want a solely white Britain. After leaving PA, Yerbury founded the Nationalist Support Detachment, NSD, which provides security for far-right events. Yerbury had aspirations for the NSD to also be far-right shock troops, which could be used against the left. He explicitly spoke of targeting picket lines, and Hope Not Hate argues that the aim of the NSD was to create a cadre primed for confrontation with the left, especially the trade unions, end quotes. Yerbury seems to have shifted, for now, towards electoral politics and hopes to use his extensive links with the British far right to hold public meetings and field candidates for the NRP. PA's leader, Mark Collett, has described Galloway's victory in Rochdale as a, quote, blow to the system, end quotes, and for a chance for positive change. It seems likely that this is motivated by Galloway's anti-Zionist beliefs. Elsewhere, PA is running three independent candidates in council elections. Page 12. Transnistria, Moldova, and Putin, debate by Dan Katz. Transnistria is a long, thin strip of territory formerly part of Moldova, sandwiched between the Dniester River and the Ukrainian border. The area forms about 12% of Moldovan territory. 470,000 people live in the region. It declared independence from Moldova in September 1990 and independence from the Soviet Union in August 1991. Following a short civil war ending in July 1992 after 700 people had died, fought between Moldovan troops and secessionist militias actively backed by the Russian 14th Army, Transnistria became de facto an independent state. The main issue during the conflict was the language question. In 1990, the Moldovan parliament decided for provocative nationalist reasons that the single official language would be Moldovan in Latin script. Russian speakers objected. Arms dump. Since 1992, Russia has garrisoned a small force, currently around 1,500 troops in Transnistria. Although the Russian government signed a treaty 25 years ago saying it would remove its troops, the soldiers remain alongside an enormous Soviet-era arms dump containing 20,000 tons of munitions and armaments. Transnistria also has its own armed force of 15,000. Moldova's badly equipped army of 5,000 is probably no match for the Russian Transnistrian forces. The vast Russian arms store at Kobsana, Transnistria, is located 2 kilometers from the Ukrainian border. It has been estimated that if the weapons were all exploded, the blast would be equivalent to the nuclear explosion at Hiroshima. Transnistria is only 70 kilometers from the key Ukrainian port of Odessa. Transnistria has all the trappings of a sovereign country with its own parliament, flag, currency, passport, and constitution. However, it is recognized by no other state. Its money can only be exchanged within the statelet, and its passport is effectively useless. Most Transnistrians have Moldovan passports, although some have Russian or Ukrainian papers. 90% of the people of Transnistria are Moldovan citizens. The ethnic breakdown is 29% Russian, 29% Moldovan, 23% Ukrainian in 2015 figures. Government-controlled territory in Moldova has 2.8 million people. According to the 2014 census, 80% of those questioned in government-controlled areas said their main language was Moldovan-Romanian, essentially identical, with 55% describing the language as Moldovan and 23% Romanian. 9% declared Russian as their main language. Moldova's language and culture is Romanian. Its recent history as a distinct political unit dates from its creation as a republic in the USSR after Stalin forced Romania to cede the territory in the 1940s, in the period of the Hitler-Stalin Pact. Numerous cases alleging abuses in Transnistria have been taken to the European Court. These include Transnistria's banning of the use of Moldova's Latin script, the closure of organizations using the Romanian language, and the use of torture in the Transnistrian prison system. Transnistria has responded by making it illegal for people in the area to make complaints to international authorities, a crime now punishable by 10 years in jail. The German news broadcaster Deutsche Welle describes Transnistria in this way, quotes, "Outwardly, Transnistria is a gigantic Soviet outdoor museum with monuments to Lenin, red flags, and hammer and sickle symbols galore. However, in fact, it is the extensive premises of a holding company called Sheriff and a military depot run by a small number of former KGB officers who are now probably working for the GRU, Russia's military intelligence, end quotes. Transnistria under Sherif became a center for smuggling, gun running, and money laundering. Moldova, the poorest country in Europe after Ukraine, now has a pro-European government, and a referendum in 2014 showed overwhelming support for joining the European Customs Union. Moldova was granted candidate status in the European Union in June 2022. Moldova's stagnant economy and widespread corruption have created a demographic decline, and over half of the population are pensioners. Ukraine war. Moldova has been attempting to make itself less vulnerable to Russian attacks and provocations by making itself less dependent on Russian gas supplies, finally accomplished in 2023. On Wednesday, the 28th of February, there was much speculation that the authorities in Transnistria would demand incorporation into Russia, provoking a crisis if Russian President Vladimir Putin should use a major speech the next day to accept their offer. In fact, a Transnistrian Congress of Deputies of all levels did convene on 28th of February, but made the limited demands of Russian protection in the face of an economic war being waged against Transnistria by the Moldovan government. The immediate background to the current tensions in Transnistria is the Ukraine war. In February 2022, following the Russian full-scale invasion of Ukraine, Ukraine sealed the Ukraine-Transnistria border, cutting off smuggling routes. In July 2024, the Moldovan government declared that all imports into Transnistria would be subject to customs duties. Moldova's president, Maia Sandu, said, quotes, "We are making small steps for the economic reintegration of the country," end quotes. The new custom rules have increased prices in Transnistria. Originally, 450,000 Ukrainians fled to Moldova following the February 2022 Russian invasion, of which 100,000 remain. Most Ukrainian refugees then moved further west into Europe. Putin would like to spread agitation in Transnistria to Gagauzia, an area in the south of Moldova run by a pro-Russian politician, Yevgenia Gutsul. On 7th of March, Gutsul was in Russia meeting Russian officials and asking Russia to provide Gagauzia with cheap gas. Gagauzia and Terekhlia have a combined, largely pro-Russian population of 100,000. Russia should remove its troops, allowing Transnistria to reintegrate with Moldova and join the EU. The Moldovan government should recognize Russian as an official language. Momentum Convention, a mixed bag, by a Momentum member. The left labor grouping Momentum held its first ever members' convention via Zoom on 10th of March 2024, 8.5 years after the group was set up. Gaza, moved by Carol Turner of Labour, CND and Socialist Action, was chosen as the campaign priority. Momentum should indeed already have been much more active on Gaza, but since not, the vote was more like an exercise in virtue signalling, an added sort of virtue to my mind. The plan endorsed boycott, divestment and sanctions, though a big section of the BDS movement has interpreted BDS as boycott of the actual Palestinian Jewish anti-war movement with Israel standing together. I backed the tax the rich to fund the NHS as campaign priority. Momentum at its height had 40,000 members and many local groups. It now has 10,000 members and very few functioning local groups. Labour membership has dropped less. It is 376,000 now, 485,000 in 2019, 564,000 at its Corbyn peak in 2017. Its Blair Brown era low was 156,000. The convention had a maximum of 205 people logged into Zoom. Momentum still, however, has 11 paid staff, whereas many other Labour left groups currently and historically have had none. The convention passed a motion designed to facilitate a voice for socialism in the general election. However, the proposed political content is bland and unclear, with no amendments allowed and decisions to be by Momentum's committee. We think it's unwise for Labour left internationalists to slow down on its parallel efforts, which are likely to carry sharper policies. There was arguments about constitutional amendments, but those passed looked unlikely to change Momentum's functioning much. Page 13. Food Couriers Pause Action by Michael Elms. Since January, food delivery couriers working for Deliveroo and other platforms have been on strike against low pay. The strike has now been paused until later on in April. The strike was organised by a group of mostly Brazilian couriers calling themselves Delivery Job UK, based mainly in London. A series of days of action organised by this group caused Deliveroo several very substantial losses, 40% of their London business on Valentine's Day. Part of the reason for the strength of these strikes lay in Delivery Job UK's social media strategy. Their decision to picket Deliveroo's dark kitchens belonging to a big chain restaurants which produce exclusively for delivery, was another source of power. With the help of the IWGB and networks left over from the national 2021-22 strike movements, in which workers' liberty played an important role, strikes spread across the UK and began to involve hundreds of drivers in the West Midlands, the North East, the South Coast, as well as Scotland and Ireland. The spread of the strike presented new organisational challenges for the strike leaders. To consolidate their organisation, recoup energy after a very strenuous couple of months and consider their strategy, the leaders of the movement in London have decided to pause the action for some weeks before returning to the fight. This is a difficult moment for the strike, as it would be for any movement, but the strike unleashed in late January was the biggest in the history of the industry and maybe the most costly. Step-by-step workers in the food delivery industry are approaching a strong level of organisation and advancing towards their goal of civilising this hyper-exploitative industry. Amazon, More Strikes by Ollie Moore. Amazon workers at two sites in the West Midlands will strike again in March. Workers at the BHX4 site in Coventry, where the GMB union has its biggest base, are striking on the 19th and 20th of March. At a new site in Sutton Coldfield, Birmingham, on 27th and 28th of March. Workers at the Birmingham site struck for the first time in January. The strikes are part of a long-running campaign by workers to win a £15 an hour minimum wage. Although Amazon has so far refused to negotiate directly with the GMB, the pressure from the strike campaign has already forced it to up its rates of pay, which will rise again from April to £13 an hour. The GMB has recently submitted a new claim to the Central Arbitration Committee, the government's body responsible for adjudicating claims for union recognition. If GMB can show its members that BHX4 are more than 50% of the workforce, the CAC could compel Amazon to formally recognise the union and establish a collective bargaining structure. This would be the first formal union recognition agreement at any Amazon site in the UK. Winning union recognition would be a huge gain. To capitalise on it, should it be won, GMB members will need to use it as a springboard for pressing further demands for improved terms and conditions and continuing efforts to spread the strikes to other sites. This will allow them to avoid settling into an institutional relationship with Amazon, which sees the bargaining structures themselves, rather than workers' action, as the principal mechanism for winning change. Defend Rights to Bad Posters by Kathy Nugent. On 20th of February, security staff at Queen Mary University in London, acting under instruction from the management, broke into the offices of the University of College Union, UCU, to remove two posters. One produced by the Palestine Solidarity Campaign highlighted the slogan, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." The other, produced by the UCA, called for a Gaza ceasefire. Management claims the posters were causing a chilling effect on freedom of speech, on campus. The union branch's defense of "From the river to the sea, presumably the real target," is a statement in favor of a singular secular state across Israel or Palestine. Workers' Liberty has criticisms of that solution. It is far from democratic, from the democratic ideal it purports to be, an explicit denial of the national rights of the Israeli Jewish community in place of mutual recognition. We counter such ideas through political debate. Ripping down posters is exactly the opposite of creating a climate of free speech where debate can happen. Further, the raid is an attack on the union's right to organize, part of a pattern of intimidation against Palestinian solidarity campaigning on campuses. Bombastic, dogmatic instead of critical. Eye on the Left by Rodri Evans. In the last 60 years, though not the previous history of Marxist movements, have seen several precedents for the current frenzy of the Socialist Appeal Group about to rename itself Revolutionary Communist Party. All those essays ended sorrily, but they were nearer realism than the RCP today. Issue 4, 14th of March, of The Communist has theses claiming that capitalism is in terminal decline, and the quotes, "the youth are completely open to radical, revolutionary, and especially communist ideas," end quotes. Thus, in this year of Lenin, the RCP can reach 10,000 members, become a mass party, and look to the conquest of power. Almost all the articles in the paper pose one solution, revolution, for whatever issue they cover. How? Members must go on the streets, leafleting, selling papers, and making impromptu speeches. Thus they will, quotes, "find and train new communists." Literally millions of young people identify as communists. All we have to do is to find them, end quotes. In 1850, Marx wrote against Willich and Schepper, who advocated a revolution or nothing. They too saw, quotes, finding young people keen on communism, end quotes, as a substitute for the expansion, self-education, and transformation of the labor movement. Quotes, "the point of view of the minority is dogmatic instead of critical, idealistic instead of materialistic. They regard not the real conditions, but a mere effort of will as the driving force of the revolution. Whereas we say to the workers, you will have to go through 15, 20, 50 years of civil wars and national struggles, not only to bring about a change in society, but also to change yourselves and to prepare yourselves for the exercise of political power. You say, on the contrary, either we seize power at once, or else we might as well just take to our beds. Like the bourgeoisie democrats, you substitute the catchwords of revolution for revolutionary development," end quotes. At least Willich and Schepper knew what they meant by communism and proposed to do something practical, an armed uprising. The RCP, what we fight for, includes nothing on the environment, nothing on LGBTQ rights, nothing on migrant rights, nothing on the state. It says little more on women's rights than equal pay for work of equal value. Already law for almost 50 years. An article praises George Galloway, with no criticism of his anti-woke, anti-immigrant, anti-green and hate Israel demagogy. Next step, quotes, break down the gates of parliament, storm the palaces, end quotes. Other articles variously stress removing the Tories, admits that Labour is the alternative for now, admits the RCP will not run candidates, predicts the left's, quotes, the left's in the trade unions and Labour Party will soon begin to raise their heads, end quotes, again, and advocates not voting. Incoherent bombast. Instead, study, propagandise, organise with workers' liberty. Page 14. Help us raise £15,000 by 6th of July. April is the time when solidarity readers may be getting a pay rise. This is a good opportunity to donate the first month of the rise and any back pay to our fundraiser. In the last 2 weeks, we've had an additional £390. Our total is now £1,501. A Strange Sort of Big Bang, Diary of a Track Worker by Matt Shaw. After privatisation of the railway in the mid-1990s, we were all expecting an almighty bang. That failed to materialise, or rather it did not come in the way we expected. First, there was an almighty shake-up of who was in charge day to day. Previously, each section of track work had its own line of management. Permanent Way would have supervisors and managers with a Permanent Way background, signals and telecommunications likewise, and so on. Now we had managers and supervisors from different departments with little or no experience of what we did, but expecting us to help them run the railway and hide their inefficiencies. In my own area, a new supervisor was appointed whose background was civil engineering, that is, primarily bricks and mortar. As a consequence, our work was all over the place, with some staff being sent to do the same job three times, while much higher priority work was left for months at a stretch. It all came to a head when we were sent out to bring into work some new track circuit equipment, which had been left out on tracks for nearly 6 months through a very rough winter. We told the supervisor that all the gear was knackered through a combination of vandalism, cannibalisation for spares, and bad winter weather. Not listening, he organised us an overnight stoppage of trains so that we could bring the equipment into work. No such thing occurred. We tried to get the equipment into operation, but it promptly failed. All the old equipment had to be hastily put back on just to get the service working for the first train. I doubt that we were the only department to suffer from that sort of thing. The ideology was that a new order had to succeed at any cost. We were being asked to work at distances from home even more now, with so many workers leaving through redundancy, finding other jobs and early retirement, whole projects started to stutter to a halt. Once a team of us drove to Stratford, East London, on a Monday morning from Sheffield, we were instructed to report to the on-site supervisor about testing cables which were to be reused on a display diagram. They were multicoloured cables and they needed to be fully tested, which was a fiddly job at the best of times. We set to work but only completed one cable before it was time to leave and go back to Sheffield by train. We left our van on site. Every day for the next 5 days, we all travelled on the first train to London, crossed from St Pancras to Stratford via tube, tested one cable and returned home by the same route, except on the final day when the van had to go back home and where there was no time to do any testing. Again, I doubt that we were the only ones doing work that wastefully. Eventually, things calmed down, but not before a lot of time and money had been wasted as the altar of privatisation is working. Leeds Pledges No Work Notices by Alan Gilbert. At the Yorkshire and Humber TUC Congress on the 16th of March, 16th to 17th of March, Leeds City Council leader James Lewis said his council would never use the Tories' Minimum Service Act, which left the government set minimum service levels in various sectors, and then employers issue work notices to oblige named workers to break strikes to deliver those levels. There will be a formal vote on this at a full council meeting on 20th of March, though the wording looks unclear. On 9th of December 2023, Lewis joined with several other Labour council leaders and mayors to declare, quote, "We will work with trade unions and employers to explore every possible option to avert any prospect of work notices being issued in our areas," end quote. The first option is for the councils not to issue work notices themselves where they are the employer. The Scottish Government and One Academy Train United Learning have already said they will not issue work notices. The Welsh Government and Islington Council have made statements simply strongly implying that a no work notices resolution passed by Leeds Central CLP on 29th of February has been cited as background to Lewis's new statement. Islington South CLP has passed a resolution 21st of February asking Islington Council to make its no work notices policy explicit. A 1940 film about the miners' battles, Keen Eye by John Cunningham. This week and for another few weeks, I will introduce films for the 40th anniversary of the 1984-85 miners' strike. The first of those, The Stars Look Down, 1940, was based on the 1935 novel by A.J. Cronin and directed by Carol Reed. It is set at the fictional Neptune Colliery in the northeast and centres on Davy Fenwick, Michael Redgrave, son of a local miners leader, Bob Fenwick. Davy intends to go to college and hopes with education he can assist in the improvement of conditions in the mining industry. But Jenny Sunley Margaret Lockwood persuades him to abandon his studies. They are married, but it does not work out. Then Davy is sacked by the local school where he has become a teacher. He takes a part-time job tutoring the son of Richard Barris, the mine manager, and overhears a conversation where Barris talks of reopening a part of a mine, Scupper Flats, which is prone to flooding and has already caused one strike. He tries to warn the miners of the danger. Davy is a keen and vocal advocate of nationalisation, a growing sentiment within the industry, the trade union movement and the Labour Party during the war. On the first day of January 1947, Vesting Day, whose aspirations were realised. The Stars Look Down is not available for streaming by some excerpts, but a DVD is available. Page 15. Stop Cuts at Goldsmiths by a UCU member. A ballot of members at the University and College Union UCU at Goldsmiths University of London, ending on the 28th of March, has been called to fight the threatened cuts of 130 full-time equivalent posts. In reality, up to a third of all academic jobs at the college. This is probably the worst in a wave of cuts affecting many universities across the UK. Higher education bosses point to factors including a drop in both UK and EU students and a tailing off of non-EU students, a freeze on UK tuition fees and a lack of funding for arts and humanities. Mismanagement. Goldsmiths Union knows that financial and strategic mismanagement is at the core of the problem. Goldsmiths has done nothing to fight the government's hatred of arts, humanities and increasingly social science and has subjected the college to two rounds of restructuring cuts, slashing student support damaging its reputation. The UCU nationally needs to mount a massive campaign of solidarity for Goldsmiths and other colleges facing cuts. We need to mobilise students and local communities in defence of the future of higher education. Tata, nationalise, don't subsidise, by Katie Toller. Unions are balloting for strikes following the announcement of massive job cuts at Tata Steel. The Indian conglomerate Tata, which has recorded profits of over £23 billion, has confirmed this month that it plans axing up to 2,800 jobs. It will close two blast furnaces at Port Talbot, with potential redundancies also at another site in Llanwern. It is already closing the Morpha coke ovens in Port Talbot on 20th of March. Tata Steel currently employs 8,000 people in the UK, 3,859 people at the Port Talbot site. A protest has been held in Port Talbot and workers from the Llanwern site, where 917 are employed, have marched in Newport city centre. Speaking at the Port Talbot's rally, Unite General Secretary Sharon Graham said there have been almost 6,400 jobs lost in the British steel industry since 2015. Tata has eyes on more government funding for green transition, even whilst dismissing thousands of workers. A document for the company says, quote, Tata Steel has also made clear that with the right investment and policy environment, it is open to further investments, such as in the direct reduced iron DRI plant. We would look at the case for a potential DRI plant in the UK if the business conditions are right and if in future the government supported further investment. The document also directly addresses the prospect of a Labour government, adding that the company, quote, is open to further investment in the future, end quote, but not that it wants to turn the Port Talbot plant to profit first. Labour has said it will invest £3 billion in the steel industry, and it is seriously considering backing hydrogen steelmaking as an option. Tata has received about £1 billion in pledged state funding. Half of that will support Port Talbot's switch to electric arc furnaces, remaking new steel from the UK's abundant scrap, while the rest will help Tata, which also owns Jaguar Land Rover, builds a gigafactory to make batteries for electric cars. Tata's touting for hundreds of millions of pounds more in subsidies whilst workers are left unemployed shows further weaknesses in Labour's green investment pledge. Without centering just transition for workers, workers' control and nationalisation, green investment can become subsidy for profits of already rich companies. The company and GMB unions working with Syndex have developed the multi-union plan for Port Talbot, which has been presented to Tata Steel. Unite has also produced a similar plan for steel, which goes further with plans to increase UK steel production through protectionism. The plan includes a British steel-only rule on government's contracts and a subsidy for energy costs similar to plans in Germany. The German government has been criticised for policies which subsidise high energy consumption across German industry. Unite has announced it is balancing 1,500 workers. Community is also balloting and represents more steel workers than any other union, including the majority of workers impacted by Tata's decarbonisation plans. Despite all of the unions producing plans for steel, we fear that they are using ballots to leverage redundancy promises rather than transition arrangements to avoid job cuts at Tata. Pay, Time to Fight to Win, by a PCS member. national disaggregated strike ballots in the PCS Civil Service Union over pay, job protection and pensions will run from 18th of March to 13th of May. Background: a period of unprecedented long-term pay decline with the Tories seemingly bent on imposing another poor pay round in 2024. The government has recently acknowledged that, quotes, civil service average pay within grades have shown a general downward trend in real terms since 2008 due to below inflation increases, end quotes. PCS's own research shows that civil service median annual pay by grade has fallen by up to 38%. PCS desperately needs to win the 171 legal ballots across the delegated bargaining units into which civil servants are divided and ruled. Unfortunately, the Left Unity LU leadership of PCS has been undermining the prospects of a membership fight back. In 2023, they wrecked our strike campaign for a 10% pay across the board pay increase in 2022 to 23 and added not one additional consolidated penny to our salaries. They stood as the Tories inflicted below inflation awards across the civil service in the 2023 to 24 pay round. They missold the 2023-24 below inflation awards as an achievement, echoing the Tories' claim that it was a good settlement. They boosted and spun the national talks, which predictably have resulted in no government concessions. They have failed to undertake a serious propaganda campaign for the last 9 months. The pay demands are deliberately vague. Quotes, restoration means that in addition to an inflation-proof pay rise, measured how is the demand less than the previous 10%, we want some redress for everything that has come before, end quotes. The industrial action strategy is again to be based only on selective strike action with minimum national action. PCS Independent Left, IL, supporters on the National Executive Committee, NEC, proposed that the pay demands be clearer and that the ballots be delayed by 1 month to allow for intensive campaigning amongst members. LU rejected those proposals. With NEC elections approaching 18th of April to 9th of May, they are desperate to look like a leadership that fights for members. IL and other activists will work to deliver votes for strikes while contesting the NEC elections in principled alliance with other groups. The alliance has received 66 to 70 plus nominations per candidate, running parallel with the long dominant LU slate. Our immediate slogan is clear: win the strike ballot and elect a new leadership that wants to win the dispute. Page 16. Sheriff of Nottingham votes against cuts, by Liam Conway. On Monday the 4th of March, Councillor Shigotafta Kudos, the Sheriff of Nottingham, was the only councillor in the city to vote against the government's imposed cuts. His speech was a simple but powerful message for her Labour councillors delivered to those outside City Hall and later in the council chamber itself. Quotes, kids in care, people in temporary accommodation, vulnerable adults, our social workers, social housing tenants, our charities and volunteers, our artists and protectors of culture do not have a vote, but I do, and I will vote against this budget today. It's true that Nottingham has been pushed to the edge by Tory austerity, but surely times of crisis require us to be bolder. Rubber stamping this budget with a heavy heart will do little for the 500 people whose jobs are at risk, end quotes. Councillor Kudus concluded with a demand that the rest of the council stand with the thousands of Nottingham people who had signed a petition demanding an end to their cuts. On the following Saturday, 9th of March, the Sheriff of Nottingham poignantly led a march from the Robert Hood statue into the council house, where a supportive campaign cheered every word she spoke about why we need defiance, not compliance, in the face of government-imposed cuts. Shu Gupta has now been suspended from the Labour Party for breach of the rules governing local councillors, rules ironically introduced in 2016 during the Corbyn era. The three big unions representing city council workers in Nottingham are also the three biggest affiliates to the Labour Party, Unison, Unite and the GMB. Shu Gupta has stood by city council workers in those unions. Those unions from the very top should now demand that Shu Gupta is reinstated as both a Labour Party member and a Labour councillor. In the meantime, we've worked to do fighting the cuts at workplace level. At the march and rally on Saturday the 9th of March, workplaces faced immediate threats of closure were represented by workers who want to fight to defend their jobs and services, such as the Jackdaw Complex Care Team. We should support strikes, occupations, localised public meetings in defence of community centres, activity centres, libraries and provision like Jackdaw. However, so far it remains a minority of workers and service users prepared to demand defiance in place of compliance. A public meeting on Thursday the 21st of March will seek to look at ways we can effectively mobilise across the city against the cuts, in demanding, as the general election looms, that Labour reverses the cuts and restores central government funding to at least 2010 levels. There is much to play for in Nottingham and the chance to spread the campaign to other towns and cities threatened with huge cuts like Birmingham and Coventry. In particular, we need the unions at branch, regional and national level to mobilise their members in action against the cuts alongside local trade councils and anti-cuts campaigns. Tory Demagogues Turn on Dissent, by Colin Foster. The Tory government is adding layer upon layer of restriction and suppression of protest. Its latest move is its new definition of extremism, announced on the 14th of March. Groups judged extremist will, it seems, not necessarily be banned, but the government will shun them and the Tories will put pressure on Labour to shun them. Labour leaders' feeble response so far suggests their Tories' gambits may well embarrass Labour. Yet it is so transparent that three former Tory Home Secretaries, including the very right-wing Priti Patel, protested in advance of the 14th of March. Tory-appointed Anti-Extremism Commissioner Robin Simcox, who previously worked in the Trumpite Heritage Foundation in the USA, has upped the hype by claiming on the 7th of March that Gaza ceasefire demonstrations turn all central London into a no-go area for Jews. He was following on former Tory Minister Paul Scully, 26th of February, and former Tory Deputy Chair Lee Anderson, now with Nigel Farage's Reform Party, 23rd of February. Solidarity has criticised the chief megaphone slogans and placards on the Gaza demonstrations, From the River to the Sea, for example, which since 2002-2003 at least has meant suppression of Israel. Because we have criticised, we are well placed to answer the Tory demagogy without dissimulation. Ideas should be combated by ideas, actions by actions. There are more than enough laws restraining hurtful action by protesters. Measures to restrict ideas diverging a lot, extremely, from consensus or orthodoxy may trouble reactionaries here and there, but in the long run will more surely hurt advocates of liberation. On the ceasefire protests, we have been loud with ideas of two states and Jewish-Arab workers' unity disliked by the megaphonists. The protests have not been a no-go area for us. We've had one case, I think, of comrades being surrounded by angry protesters shouting Zionist at them, but that is about all. And if there are more, offensive or even abhorrent verbal excesses always a risk on angry protests. Against such abuse, we rally our forces and call on the rest of the left to help defend us, not on the cops for suppression. It would be hopeless to rely on the Tory government to suppress Tory party action against migrants or the police to suppress police abuses. To support bigger powers for the government and the police in the hope that they will tamp down the elements of protest we dislike but let other elements flourish is foolish. The Guardian reports that official guidance for the government's scheme against radicalisation lists socialism, communism and anti-fascism among warning signs. Defend the right to protest against reactionary slogans, counter-protests and united fronts to defend those targeted. Page 17. End the War, Peace, Two States by Ira Bekovic. On the evening of Tuesday of the 12th of March, Israeli snipers shot and killed Rami al-Halouhili, a 13-year-old Palestinian resident of occupied East Jerusalem. The military alleges al-Halouhili had shot fireworks at them. Responding to the killing, far-right Israeli minister Itamar Ben-Gvir said, quotes, "I salute the fighter who killed a terrorist," end quotes. At least three others, including another minor, were also killed in Israeli military raids. These deaths are a reminder that whilst local and global attention is focused on Israel's war in Gaza, the occupation of the West Bank continues to claim lives. The period since 7th of October has been seen both a spike in settler violence against Palestinians and an intensification of Israeli military control in the West Bank, including numerous deadly raids. Although the mobilizations the Hamas leaders called for in Jerusalem have not yet taken place, the increase in Israeli military pressure and the killing of Palestinians makes upheavals in the West Bank more likely. The Israeli far-right signal that they positively wish for that so that they can launch heavier military attacks in the West Bank and further push back the Palestinians. They also signal that they want full-scale war across Israel's northern border with Lebanon. The death toll in Gaza also continues to rise with Israeli air strikes and ground offensives ongoing. Over 30,000 people have now been killed, a large majority of which, according to Israel's own total for Hamas fighters it has killed, are civilians. A large proportion are children. Many more could die as the result of a deepening humanitarian crisis as the population suffers from lack of access to healthcare, food and other basic supplies. As we go to press, negotiations are still underway for a ceasefire and a hostage release agreement. We want a permanent ceasefire and a peace deal, but an immediate ceasefire of any length is preferable to the indefinite continuation of slaughter and preferable to the Israeli government's going ahead with its threatened large-scale attack on the refugee-packed city of Rafah.